I'm Georgie Crawford. You're listening to the Good Glow podcast. Throughout my treatment for breast cancer, I realised the importance of self-care. Whether that's a 5 kilometre run, a checkup with your GP, or even a 5 minute dip in the sea, the time has come for us to put ourselves higher on our own to-do list. This season, I've teamed up with Vichy. Vichy is a doctor-founded dermocosmetic brand with 90 years of skincare expertise. Vichy has established the link between health and beauty and led the way in skincare innovation. Powered by active ingredients, product formulations are clinically proven, hypoallergenic and dermatologically tested for sensitive skin, making Vichy a pioneer in skin health science. Taking a holistic approach to skin health, Vichy is committed to provide safe and effective skincare routines for every skin type at every life stage. All Vichy products are available in pharmacies nationwide. Hello, I hope you are well this week. Thank you so much for tuning into the Good Glow podcast. This week, I'm joined by an amazing lady called Nicola Lavin. 15 years after she was bitten by a tick on her J1 and 15 tough years of being very sick, Nicola was diagnosed with Lyme disease. I haven't heard much about people living with Lyme disease here in Ireland, so Nicola's story is a real eye-opener. Yolanda Hadid first brought my attention to it on The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills, and I was shocked at how she was so sick, yet it seemed people questioned her illness even though she was clearly suffering so much. Nicola suffered for 15 years and was finally diagnosed. She underwent a stem cell procedure and her life improved drastically. My friend Shoshana Wood was on a sandy beach in Ireland with her family last September. She noticed that her daughter Daisy had a little black tick on her leg. And because of Nicola's story, she knew she had to act fast. She called a nurse and the nurse talked them through removing the tick safely. Daisy was treated and they were given signs and symptoms to look out for. Now Shoshana carries a tick remover with her if they're going to grassy or sandy places, and you can buy those tick removers in pharmacies. I think it's really important to know what to look out for when it comes to ticks in Ireland. I was floored by Nicola's story, her struggles, but also her amazing attitude to life. I'm so proud that the Good Glow gives people the opportunity to help others and remind us of what to look out for so we can keep our loved ones safe and well. I hope you enjoy. Nicola, welcome to the Good Glow podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Georgie.
And thank you for all the support over the last couple of years. I appreciate it so much. And you're doing so well. And it's so good to see you looking so well and healthy today.
Thank you. Thank you. And can I just say your podcast has just meant so much to me. And I'm sure for so many people as well. It's just that platform of hope and strength and just such lovely stories. So I always love listening to it every Sunday morning with a coffee in bed.
Oh, thank you so much, Nicola. And I think it's really important to add your story into the Good Glow community because I think it's so important. I've been following you over the last couple of years. I read your blog, I've read your story in full. And I don't know why, I've always been quite interested in Lyme disease. As we were saying on the phone, you're probably sick of people saying, oh, that's what Yolanda Hadid has, or, you know, all these celebrities in America.
But in a way, it's good because it's been spoken about in public, you know, it's drawn attention to it. People are maybe, if they don't know what Lyme disease is, even just Googling it and looking it up. And, you know, it's good to have faces like that kind of to associate with it, you know, to associate with an illness, even though it's not the nicest illness to have, of course. But like, yeah, just to have big voices like that, I suppose, makes you feel a little bit validated in a way. And that you're not the only one going through it.
The listeners will understand what you mean by that as they hear your story, because it was such a long road for you to be diagnosed. Yeah. And I know that you said on your blog that when you were finally diagnosed, you celebrated with a glass of champagne, because often people are on this really long journey to be diagnosed with something. And finally, when you're told this is what it is, it is such a relief, because then you can look to treatment.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I didn't quite realize the kind of rocky road I was going down with Lyme disease, but like you said, when I got the news, I was actually in Dublin to see an infectious disease doctor, and I had saved up a lot of money to go and see him, and I was hoping maybe he would give me some answers. And I had sent off my bloods to be tested in Germany because the tests here just aren't that great. And I was with my sister. She had just had a baby and she was coming with me to the doctor, and I got the email to say that my bloods had tested positive for Lyme disease. The PCR test now that we do for the COVIDs, it was, you know, the same sort of test, and they could detect the bacterial DNA in my blood. And I celebrated. We went for a small little glass of champagne, and I thought, this is it now, you know, road to recovery. But I didn't quite realise that it would be such a journey. But
And you've been so great at sharing your journey, and I'm sure lots of people maybe who are newly diagnosed have been looking to you for support. So let's go back to the summer of 2000, a summer so many of us have had in America, and tell us a little bit about your time there.
Yeah, so I was in my fourth year of a five-year college degree course. It was a pretty intense college degree. Like, I'm a medical scientist, so I do all those tests that we talk about, the blood tests and Lyme tests and all that sort of stuff. And that's what I was training for. And I just wanted a summer of fun with my friends. And I had never done the J1 thing. So I thought, well, if I'm going to do it, this is the year, because, you know, I'm heading into a pretty intense career after this. And so I headed off with my two girlfriends, and we had just a great summer living in Montauk and, you know, working and partying and all the typical things you do on your J1 as a student in America. So, yeah, it was an amazing summer.
And Montauk is actually, if anyone's watched The Affair, I think it's filmed there,
yes,
isn't it? So it's like big, huge beaches. And you said in your blog that you were walking through the grass to go to work.
Yeah.
And it was a beautiful place.
I was working in this absolutely fabulous resort in the spa, and they would have like MTV beach parties, so like you'd have Jennifer Lopez and Carson Daly, and you know, it was just like dreams that an Irish girl probably never would have thought, like, oh, I'm standing there and Jennifer Lopez is over there. And it was just incredible summer. Like, back then I never got sick, so I never even thought about getting sick, and I just was oblivious to, you know, anything to do with ticks, really. I mean, I had learned a little bit about it in college, obviously, and I think apart from that, I would never have heard of Lyme disease before. As you said, I was walking through the grass and didn't realize that a tick had managed to kind of make its way from the grass up my leg and travel right through my body. And it was under my armpit that I got bitten. I didn't actually see the tick. It was just that area became really, really kind of almost like itchy and inflamed, and just, you know, I thought, oh, I've got a bite or something, and that was it. I didn't really think much about it.
And how old were you at this point?
So I was 22.
22. Yeah. Wow, so young.
And actually, I was due to fly home pretty much, I think, the next week or two. So I had started to get sick. I got like flu-like symptoms. I'd started to feel really achy. I got really, really, really nauseous. And I just kind of thought, well, I'll go to the doctor when I get home. You know, kind of at that point, all I wanted to do was get home. So I made the flight home and went to see my GP when I got back. And she kind of ran some standard tests and just said, oh, it's just, you know, well, she said stomach flu, you know. So it was some sort of a flu because I was throwing up so much. So I kind of failed to mention that I had my boyfriend of 5 years at the time. When I went to America, I decided to leave him behind and just do, you know, the whole girly holiday, because I had never done that before. But he missed me too much and kind of came out halfway through my time in New York, and he joined me. So we flew home together, and when I went back to the doctor after about 10 weeks of just feeling horrible and really bad nauseous, she decided to run a pregnancy test because of the nausea, and that turned out to be positive. So I became pregnant with my son over there that summer and didn't realize it. And yeah, I was about 10, 11 weeks into, no, it was probably about 12 weeks nearly into the pregnancy before I got that test, you know, that she told me I was pregnant. And I hadn't even noticed that I wasn't getting my period because I was so sick. So like, it was just crazy. And then because I'd never, obviously I was 22, I'd never been pregnant before. I didn't know what to expect. I kind of just thought, oh, well, maybe everyone is supposed to feel this sick, you know? So I spent that whole pregnancy, and I know I was listening to Julie as well, saying that, you know, she had that sickness throughout her whole pregnancy. I laugh and I used to say it was morning, noon and night sickness. Like, I was sick the whole pregnancy and couldn't keep anything down. I weighed less after I had Aaron than before I got pregnant. So it was just not a great experience. Well, I did, you know, and I didn't know any different, but I just thought everybody felt that way when they were pregnant.
So that was your main symptom then, just feeling nauseous.
And like flu-like, kind of, you know, sore joints. It was kind of like almost like a knock-on effect. It was like one thing after another. It was like, oh, now I've got headaches. So, you know, I'm retaining a lot of fluid. I'm not, you know, it was just kind of like a lot of things were going wrong. And as I said, I was doing my final year in college. I continued to do that. And we got to sit our final exams, I think, in February. And for the rest of our degree, we were supposed to do a project in a hospital. And I chose Galway because I just wanted to get back to my mom. You know, I just wanted to, you know, when you're not feeling well, you just want your mom around. So I just decided, yeah, I'm going to do my final degree project in Galway. And myself and my boyfriend moved back to Galway. We rented a house. And I wasn't due Aaron until June. But by March, I was already ended up in hospital. And I didn't get to leave hospital until I had him. So it was pretty horrendous. Like, I missed my sister's 21st. I, you know, like, loads of things had happened in between. But at that point, like, my bloods were all showing that maybe I had preeclampsia, and they just kind of wanted to keep an eye on me, and they didn't really know what was going on. So they decided to induce me a little bit early in May, the beginning of May, which is the day of my birthday. They induced me, and on the 3rd of May, Aaron was born. So I had a C-section then, and they just, Aaron was born. And I kind of thought, well, that's going to be the end of everything now. You know, I can start to be a new mom now. And, you know, it's such an exciting time of life. And yeah, I just didn't really think how bad things would get after that.
Because you already had, that's a lot for you, you know, to come home from your J1, to be pregnant, to be feeling all of these symptoms. Of course, it's great to have your kids young and things like that. And now you get to enjoy your son, and you're still young yourself. But exactly, it was a lot for you to deal with.
It was. But I kind of thought that by his birth, once they, you know, a lot, they kind of told me, once you have the baby, you'll start to feel better. So I kind of had thought, okay, well, maybe my body just didn't enjoy being pregnant, but now I have the baby, I'm going to start to heal and I'm going to start to feel better. And Aaron, because he was a good few weeks premature, and he was a big baby, like, he was 7 pounds 13 and he was 5-6 weeks early. So I can't imagine what size he would have been if I had gone full term. And so they thought initially, oh, you know, he's a big thriving baby, he's going to be fine. But quite early on, they saw some problems with him, with his breathing and stuff, and he was very badly jaundiced. I just thought he was really tan. So they took him to the neonatal baby unit, and I was kind of kept in the maternity unit with all the other babies, you know, all the other moms with their babies, and he was in the neonatal unit. And then I started to realize that as I was lying down at night, I was struggling with this cough. It was like I just couldn't catch my breath. So I was coughing really badly. And I'm not joking, Georgie, I swole up like Michelin woman. I went from size 8 to size 18 overnight for pajamas. My dad had to go to like pick me up some new pajamas because I couldn't fit in. I just swole up with so much fluid. So the fluid wasn't getting pumped around my body, and they couldn't figure out what was going on. But they just kind of thought, oh, you know, you've got a bit of cellulitis or something from the pregnancy, you'll be fine. You've developed a bit of asthma from some of the medications, you'll be fine. And I didn't really think that much of it. And Aaron got discharged from the neonatal baby unit like 7 days after that. And we all went home and, you know, I kind of thought, oh, this is my family now, or, you know, first night at home. And it wasn't Aaron that kept me up all night, because like he slept through the night. He was the best baby. I just couldn't breathe. I couldn't catch my breath. I was really struggling. And I remember my boyfriend at the time, I could see in his eyes that he was really worried. Like I remember standing at the window just trying to get some air in. I couldn't breathe. And so we walked to the doctor the next day. Like, we were young, we didn't have a car, you know, the way it is. We walked to the doctor the next day and she was really concerned. Like, she was the first person to spot that there was something really badly wrong. And she gave me a referral letter to go back to maternity, back to the hospital, and just to have a check, make sure everything was okay. And we made the long walk to the hospital and we got there and they were like, no, you're fine. It's just your asthma. They gave me a prescription for 2 inhalers and sent me back home. So we walked the whole way home with, you know, a brand new baby needing to be fed. And then my parents came to visit that afternoon. And at that stage, my lips had turned blue. I wasn't getting any oxygen in at all. And they were just like, because I had been to the hospital and they had told me I'd be fine, I was fine. I was like, no, I'm fine. I don't want to, you know, stress anyone out. Or I'm, you know, they just said it's my asthma. But my mom knew straight away. She was like, you need to go to the hospital.
At that point, you have been suffering for so long.
True.
Do you feel like, oh God, I can't go in now with another problem? Were those sort of things running through your mind?
Not really at that point, because I, in my head at that point, it was the pregnancy that was causing it all. So not at that point, but certainly down the line, I did start to have those feelings. And when I went back in to A&E that time, they could tell immediately that there was something really seriously wrong with me. And I was admitted back into maternity at that point and put on oxygen straight away. And they really couldn't figure out what was wrong with me, what was causing that problem. It took them a while. And I remember they were sending me for different scans and different x-rays and, you know, and I was just getting worse and worse and worse. I couldn't even hold Aaron at this point. I don't even know where he was, to be honest. He was in the care of my parents or my boyfriend, or like, I just didn't really know what was going on. And then I remember I started to kind of stabilize a little bit on the oxygen and I was doing okay. But the nurses could tell by my bloods or by my oxygen levels were getting worse and worse and worse. And I remember them coming in and sitting on the bed and saying, okay, Nicola, we're just a little bit concerned now about your oxygen levels. So we're going to transfer you to the higher dependency unit so that they can, you know, keep an eye on you there and check everything's okay. But when they tried to transfer me, the bed that I had, like, you know, the way under in a hospital bed, there's oxygen tanks under every bed. Like, I had been attached to the oxygen tanks on the wall. So there's oxygen tanks under every bed. When they tried to transfer me, they realized very suddenly that that oxygen tank was empty and there was no oxygen in it. And like, literally, it was like drowning for me. It was that sensation of I couldn't get any air. My lungs had filled up with fluid. So it was just that sensation of drowning. And I remember the doctor jumped on top of my bed with, you know, one of the bags, the oxygen bags, trying to bag me. And I looked in his eyes and I could tell that he was so scared. And I just knew, okay, there's something really serious happening here. It was a bit like Fawlty Towers. They couldn't get the bed fitted into the lift and everything. And like, this was like, everything had to happen fast. And it was just a bit of a panic. And I just remember closing my eyes and thinking, I just can't do this anymore, because I was like literally suffocating. And I felt so sad, because I knew, like, at that time, I felt like I would never see my baby again. I'd never see him grow up. And it was, yeah, my heart stopped. And they had to revive me and bring me back to life. So I had died at that point and they had to bring me back. And I'm grateful, obviously, that they did and they were able to. And it took them another few days to figure out that I was in heart failure. So my heart had failed and it wasn't pumping any fluid or anything around my body. My lungs had filled up with fluid. So that's essentially what it was like, drowning. So it was pretty horrific, pretty scary time.
So those doctors that day, from how they reacted, saved your life?
Yeah, they did. They did save my life, yeah. And if I had kind of been afraid to go back to the hospital after them telling me it was asthma, you know, I probably wouldn't have made it through either, because my heart had like stopped, you know, essentially it was just had given up. So my mom even just making me go to the hospital.
Julie Ledwidge said on my podcast that her mom made her go to the hospital after she had her first baby. And it's such an important message that if you don't feel well after having a baby, you have to go back and be seen to, because all your attention goes to your lovely baby, but you have to look after yourself.
You stop thinking about yourself. And I think that's what moms are there for. Like, and especially your own mom knows you better than anybody else. So she knows what you're like when you're healthy. She knows what you're like when, you know, there's something not quite right. You might be oblivious to it yourself, but it's important to listen to those people, I think.
So you obviously had a long road after that time in your life, and you've said in your blog it took 9 years for them to test you for Lyme disease.
And I think that's what I meant when I said, like, I obviously celebrated when I got the Lyme diagnosis, but then I quickly realized if I could have got diagnosed with nearly anything else, it would have been easier. And I'm not saying that lightly, but it's like, the treatment that I got when I had the heart failure and the heart failure diagnosis was so much better than when I was going back to the doctors continuously, like you said, saying there's something wrong, there's something not quite right. So like after my heart failure, they were able to put me on medication that could kind of reverse it, not so much reverse it, but stop more damage, and my heart was able to repair itself. Like at the time it was kind of touch and go whether I would need a heart transplant, but they managed to avoid that through medication and whatever it was that they were able to do. And I just never felt right afterwards. Like my energy was really low, but like, of course, I'd just been through heart failure. I was a new mom. I now was starting a new career in a hospital. Like, of course I was going to be tired, you know, it's normal. But this was like a type of tiredness I had never experienced before. And I just felt like I was constantly pushing myself to kind of get through things. And, you know, just my energy wasn't there. So I would kind of mention this every time I was at the cardiologist, and they were like, you know, well, your heart's back in the normal range now. You should start to feel better soon. And I just never did. And then new symptoms started to crop up. Like I was going to the bathroom, and I still do 20 times a night. Like it's crazy because you don't get a full night's sleep. You're going to the bathroom constantly. I was getting really bad pins and needles down my arm. I was getting like my knee would just swell up and go burning hot and red, and like just random, totally random things. And like that's when I started to feel like, oh, I'm back in the doctors and I'm complaining about something else now. Is it just that I'm so scared after what happened with the heart failure, or like, am I looking for things to be wrong? I didn't know, even though I knew that's not my personality. I'm not that type of person at all. So, you know, I trusted myself to know that like, there's just something not quite right. And it all happened at that time when I got pregnant. So like, it was just so hard to connect the dots and to figure it out. And I had said to the doctors about my bite, but I think they were just so concerned about my heart failure that they just wanted to, you know, sort that out without worrying about the other stuff first. So, and I think that with Lyme disease, that's where the shortfall is that you just don't get anybody to listen to you in a way.
Why is that?
I don't know, because there is this rule of thought that chronic Lyme disease doesn't exist. Our healthcare system will acknowledge that acute Lyme disease exists in that you get bitten by a tick, you get a rash, you get a bullseye rash, which not everybody gets, by the way. So if you don't get the rash, you've no idea. You get your bullseye rash and you get 4 weeks of antibiotics and then it goes away. But what happens to the people who never got the rash or who never got the antibiotics and the bacteria is still in their system and it's going undetected for all these years doing damage? There's, for some reason, it's one of those illnesses that there's politics around it, there's stigma around it, there's just like disbelief. And I think that's the hardest part, you know, just trying to get mm-hmm. somebody to listen that there's something wrong.
Can you get Lyme disease in Ireland?
Yes, which is a huge misconception. And I know that I got my Lyme disease in America in Montauk. But yeah, I think people have this misconception that they're safe here in Ireland from Lyme disease. It's hugely prevalent in the Killarney National Park, in Wicklow Mountains, in Galway, kind of Connemara side. Like there's a lot of ticks test positive for Lyme disease in Ireland.
How can we protect ourselves from it?
It's not that you can stop yourself getting bitten. I mean, it's an insect at the end of the day. I suppose we just have to kind of be aware and train ourselves more of the symptoms and things to look out from. I mean, I'm sure you probably remember playing as a kid, you probably had ticks and bites and all that sort of thing. And what Lyme disease is, it's a bacteria that lives in animals like mice and birds and deer, and it happily lives in their systems causing no harm. But then the ticks, when they're drinking the blood from the deer, they're taking in all of that bacteria. And then when they bite you, they're reinfecting you with all of this bacteria that's not supposed to be in your system. And your immune system kind of just reacts to it. And how to prevent it is to obviously wear kind of long sleeves, long pants, socks pulled up, and just to check yourself if you come in from playing in areas where there's long grass. Or like, For years afterwards, I had panic attacks when my husband went to play golf because I'm like, oh, there's too much grass. Or, you know, it would be my worst nightmare for somebody else to get it. But you can't, like, that's life. You have to go out and enjoy mm-hmm. it. But I think if you just can kind of pay attention when you come in, shower, like, just look for the symptoms. And if you get any kind of, you know, flu-like symptoms, just to mention to your doctor, could it be possible that I'd have Lyme disease? Or even just to be aware of if you've got bitten. Or
and when you get bitten, does the tick go into your body or does it bite you?
No.
And
so
leave?
It bites you and then it fills with blood and then it falls off, right? So if you do happen to see that you've got a tick on you, the worst thing you can do is try to remove it by pulling it. Because what you're doing, if you squeeze the body of the tick, you're just going to, everything that's in the stomach of the tick is going to go inside your body. So there, what they say is to either get like a really pinpointed tweezers and get at the base of the tick, you know, the head of the tick, rather than the body of the tick to remove it. And if you are concerned or you have, you know, obviously you haven't developed any symptoms and you're worried about this tick, you can always put the tick in like a freezer bag, put it in the freezer. And then if you do develop symptoms, it's very easy to get that tick tested for Lyme disease to see if it was carrying it in the first place.
If, say, for example, you are bitten by a tick, if you're treated quickly,
yes,
could that then not turn into Lyme disease?
Yes. So if you got your 4 weeks of doxycycline antibiotics there and then, the chances of you developing chronic Lyme disease or like those symptoms that linger, you know, there's a very good chance that you won't develop them. Like in my case, obviously, I went kind of from 0 to 100 with the heart failure. So I was immediately, it had affected me. Some people, it can just linger for years before it starts to cause symptoms. So,
and you've spoken that it took you 15 years to get a diagnosis.
Yeah.
Did you feel in those 15 years that this is what had happened, that it was a tick bite, it was Lyme disease, or did your diagnosis shock you?
It didn't shock me in the end, but I had been kind of diagnosed with so many other things. Like what they say about Lyme disease is like it mimics other illnesses. So I had got an MS diagnosis. I had a diagnosis of fibromyalgia and chronic fatigue syndrome, or ME. I had what was the other diagnosis? Yeah, kind of ME was the one that they'd settled on before I got my Lyme disease diagnosis. And like that, like I had developed, you know, MS, I had developed blotches on my brain, stuff like that, like that they were convinced it was that initially. And then that I got an ME diagnosis. And like, it's just one of those illnesses that unfortunately likes to mimic other illnesses. So it's really hard to get a proper diagnosis.
So who ended up telling you? Was it over the phone or?
No, it was an email. So my blood tests all came back. Now, luckily, I'm a medical scientist, so I could kind of interpret my own my own blood. So, So my PCR test came back positive for Lyme disease. I took two tests. One is like an immunological response to it. So like it wasn't an antibody test, but it was similar. It was like your T cells were reacting to it. And another one was the PCR test. And both of those were rip-roaring positive for Lyme disease, which meant that the bacteria was still circulating at that point, you know, still circulating around my body at that point. How I felt. Yeah. Like initially, you know what, initially I felt like, okay, so I'm not crazy. So I'm not making it up. So, you know, I remember saying it to my dad, and my dad has the best intentions in the world, and he would have helped me to do anything. But I remember saying it to him, and he said, oh, so you really are sick. You know, it was just that validation that, your bloods are showing that you're sick, that you have this bacteria in your system and it's causing all of these issues.
What a road that you went on. And then you went and you raised 30,000 euro to get a stem cell procedure, or is it a transplant?
It's not a transplant. They're your own stem cells. So you're there for like 2 weeks, and you have to prepare your body for receiving them. So there's a lot of detox that would go on. There's a lot of, you know, they give you a lot of vitamins and anti-parasitic drugs, anti-microbials, like a lot of treatment for the 2 weeks prior. And then they take your own stem cells out of your fat cells. So it's almost like a procedure similar to liposuction. It was kind of on my back. And then they count the stem cells to make sure that you have enough, and then they give them back to you. So, it was an incredible, it just changed my life. Like it was a really, really long healing journey that was nearly harder than, it was nearly harder. No, I don't even know if it was harder. It was just, it took 2 years before I kind of felt good, you know, like now, the way I feel now. So
I'll get back to that conversation in just a minute. But first, I wanted to tell you about Vichy's iconic Hydration Serum Mineral 89. Enriched with hyaluronic acid and 89% Vichy volcanic water, which is naturally found in French volcanoes and rich in 15 minerals essential to skin health. This beautifully light gel serum gives your skin immediate hydration and glow. Think of it as a daily multi-mineral for your skin. The perfect first step in any skincare routine, suitable for all skin types. It can be used every morning and or night after cleansing your skin. For a 25% discount on Mineral 89 50ml or 75ml, use the discount code GOODGLOW25 on marspharmacy.ie. The offer is available on online purchases only until midnight, February 28th. Now, back to my conversation. So you were diagnosed then in 2015, and this procedure took place in September 2017. So it was 2 years.
Yeah.
So tell us about those 2 years. You obviously found out that this treatment was available, but it was it 30,000 euro? And you must have thought, how am I going to pay for this?
Yeah, because I had got to a point where I couldn't work anymore. So I had to kind of give up my career for a long period of time. And like I spent almost 5 years of my life completely bedbound, like in my bedroom in the dark, because I couldn't handle any light sensitivity. Like I was suffering so much neurological problems that I couldn't handle any touch. I couldn't read words on my phone. Even on a book, I couldn't make sense of sentences. Even the duvet was too heavy on my body. I was just in constant pain 24/7 for about a 5-year period. And my husband had to spoon feed me. I just didn't even have the energy to hold a spoon. I had paralysis episodes. It had just got to the point where it was like, you're in a living nightmare. You know, it's like, how is this even possible? And even your family and friends don't know how bad it gets because they're not really there. Do you know, it's just your husband mm-hmm. and your son seeing this constantly. And like, he had to bathe me, he had to feed me, you know, everything. And it was so hard. And through all of that, I had to do my own research and try and figure out a way of getting us out of this. Like, I couldn't spend my life that way, because I mean, there's living and there's living. Like, the way I was not living. Like, I know people say, you know, it would be worse if you had a terminal illness. At that point, I was so bad that I would pray that I wouldn't wake up the next day. Like, I know that sounds so horrible and life is so precious, but I wasn't living. I had, like, people's lives were going on around me and I was just in this box. Like, I lost my whole 30s to this illness. And that was the hardest, most depressing place to be. And I just knew we had to find a way out. Like, I had to research, I had to try and find a way to get better. And like, I was trying absolutely everything at that point. And I had heard about stem cells, and the scientist in me kind of kicked in, because I was like, yes, this can work. You know, it's not necessarily that I have to try and kill the bacteria, it's that I have to stop my immune system from reacting this way. All of the symptoms that I was feeling was because of my immune system reacting. I was talking to a friend in America. She was a good school friend. We had gone to school together, and she had moved to America and was living her life in Texas, and we didn't really see that much of each other. And she had seen my story and had seen me struggling. And I don't know whether it's a case of maybe from afar she could kind of see the difference in me. She knew how much we were struggling, and she's like, okay, what do you need? And I said, well, I found this treatment, but I have no idea how to raise the money for it. I just have no idea. And also, I would be so embarrassed to ask people for help. That's just not the type of person that I am. I've never, mm-hmm. you know, I never would want to fundraise. But like, at that point, my life was just, I didn't have a life, and I would have done anything to get better. So between herself and my husband, they raised the money. Just seeing people come out of the woodwork to help was just unbelievable.
What did that mean to you, you know, when you saw that money coming in to help you get your life back?
Oh, I still get emotional even thinking about it. Like, my secondary school did this big massive fundraiser, and I haven't been back there since leaving, you know. But yeah, it was just incredible to see everyone pulling together. And I suppose in a way it's hard when somebody's sick to, you know, there's nothing you can do to take it away from them. You can't take away the illness, really. But this was something that people could kind of get behind and, you know, put in an effort to show that they care. And we had raised the money. And, you know, there was also the side of it that I felt under huge pressure then, that what if the treatment doesn't work? I mean, I firmly believed that it would. I would never have gone and done it if I didn't have full belief that it would help me. But like, you do feel that pressure of all of these people are now, you know, watching my every move, make sure I'm okay. They've so much invested in this that what am I? And also the healing process is so slow. And you nearly feel like you're going backwards rather than forwards. So it was trying to have that positive mindset and just firm belief that I would get out of this and I would get better and I would get back on my feet and doing the things that I love and traveling. And it gave me such hope.
And where did this treatment take place?
So in Germany. So okay. In Germany, they understand how bad Lyme disease is, obviously, with the Black Forest there, and they get like a lot of cases of it. And there's not so much of a stigma attached to it. It's considered a very real illness. They've done a lot of research into it, a lot of research into treatment.
Tell us then what your life has been like since 2017.
So it's like, I'm a totally different person, obviously, to get a good quality of life back. I mean, I'm not perfect. I've been left with some kind of conditions. Like with Lyme disease, it's very common for it to trigger a lot of autoimmune diseases. So I've been left, and I know I sound like, oh, I've got this, you know, but it's kind of triggered an awful lot of illnesses. So I have, I'm left with lupus. I am left with mast cell activation syndrome, which means that like we have a specific immune cell called a mast cell and it produces too much histamine. So I get a lot of reactions that way, almost like allergic reactions. And then I developed the same condition that Claire Moore had that was talking to you before.
Oh,
so,
wow.
Yeah, so I have IIH as well. So they're the three that still bother me a little bit to this day. But I really don't care as long as I have some sort of a quality of life, you know, and to be able to travel and to be able to be a mom again to my son, because like, yeah, we missed out on so much time together.
Mm. So what sort of symptoms would you have now? Like,
yeah. So after my heart failure in 2000, I said to you, I never felt the same, but I had got to a point where I could work, I could go to the gym. Obviously things were very much a struggle, but it wasn't until I met my husband in around 2009, and I was having a problem with my jaw. And it's quite common in Lyme disease, and I just never made the connection, or nobody ever made the connection. And I had to go and have surgery on my jaw to break it and to widen it. And it was after that like my symptoms just exasperated. Like it just got to the point where, like I was saying to you, I was bedbound. I was having paralysis episodes. And that part was so hard for me to have my son kind of watch that and go through that. He had just kind of started secondary school at the time. And it was so traumatic for him, you know, to come and maybe see me have fainted after standing out of bed, or to, you know, I would have these paralysis episodes where I could hear everything that was going on, but I just physically couldn't move my muscles, or I couldn't speak. And they would be so like he would be crying and so upset and concerned and so worried about me, and I could hear it all going on, but I didn't have the capability of speaking and saying, I'm okay, you know, don't worry. You know, so, and even to come when I would come around from those episodes, my speech would be really slurred, and I would almost be like you'd imagine a stroke victim. Do you know, like I just couldn't get my words out, and it would be very slurred. And I know he's traumatized from that time. You know, it's a lot for a kid to kind of take on that parenting role almost, and that responsibility. And do you know, it's like, it is hard.
Yeah. And what's your life like now?
So now it's incredible. So after the stem cells, I recovered to the point where I could travel again. I started a travel blog, and like, I just want to see every single corner of the world. Like, that's my plan, is just to, you know, I suppose people are kind of understanding how much we take for granted now because of COVID and, you know, that isolation. But I kind of had that isolation for such a long period of time that I had already learned that lesson. It's like, I want to get out there. I want to explore. I want to live life. I want to go on walks. I want to go on hikes. I want to do all those things that I couldn't do before. And obviously I have to kind of pace myself and still make sure that I'm not pushing myself beyond my limit, because there was so much damage done but I'm so aware of my body now. Like, I'm so in tune. I know that if I'm starting to feel a little bit tired, I'll catch it. Whereas before, I would have pushed myself through it. And now I listen, I know every single little nuance with my body, and I just rest if I need to, you know, and I know when it's okay to kind of, you know, push myself on a walk or a hike or, you know, things like that. But life is just incredible. Like, it's amazing. So I will never take a second of it for granted again.
And do you have a doctor now in Ireland that you can talk to about your, were you assigned somebody or?
No, there's no one really that looks after Lyme disease in Ireland. And to be fair, I haven't really needed one. I have a neurologist for the IIH. I have an immunologist for the, you know, I've specific doctors for the specific symptoms I have, but I don't really have one doctor that looks after the whole, you know, Lyme disease.
Wow. And how are you hearing from people in Ireland that other people with Lyme disease?
Yeah, there's a huge community and it's really sad. Like, I think that's the reason that I keep talking about it is because I really want to, I think it's empowering to share your story with others, but I also think I know what it feels like to be so isolated and to be so lonely in that room without help, that I want to be the voice for those people that I know. You know, it's like, that's the one thing that upsets me the most, is that I know there's people going through that right now. And I would just do anything to be able to help them, you know, to put a voice to their voice when I know that they can't use their voice at the moment. So, but invisible illness, you look so fine on the outside and inside you could feel like you're dying. And it's, you know, it's just so hard for people to rationalize that you can look well but feel so unwell. So I think raising awareness about that and just, you know, putting a voice to that it's huge for me.
Well, it's such an important message because, you know, even people who are getting chemotherapy for cancer, but their hair doesn't fall out, are sometimes, you know, their friends or family are like, oh, but you're grand. Like, but when you look like somebody with cancer, it's a different story. So what you're saying is so important.
Yeah. And like I said, I got so much support and sympathy when I was kind of maybe going through the heart failure, but then less so when I started, like, I looked fine. Like, I got married during that time. I, you know, I was the picture of health as far as people were concerned, but like inside, I never felt that way. And it's it's hard for people to understand it.
And when you think back to, like, do you think about that summer in Montauk? Would you, if you could take it all back, would you do it so differently? Or
I know this sounds crazy, but I wouldn't change a single moment. I really wouldn't. Parts of it were like so hard that you can't even explain. Like, they were it was like a living hell, but I learned so much about myself, my strength, my resilience. And just even to have this platform now to be able to kind of share awareness, I feel like it happened for a reason. And I feel like I was strong enough to deal with it. And I feel like I need to be a voice now for people that, you know, just don't have a voice. So, yeah, I wouldn't change a single moment of it. It taught me so much. And like I can kind of see it now with people going through the whole COVID situation. They're seeing things, you know, it's like, they're appreciating the little things and they're appreciating, you know, life and how important it is to have that those human connections and things that we just take for granted every day. And I learned the biggest lesson with never to take a second for granted and to appreciate people and friends and to be a support for them always. And yeah, it's like, there's definitely a silver lining to be taken away in every situation, I find. Mm-hmm. It's just looking for it and just knowing that it's there.
Such beautiful words. And you do put that energy out into the world. You're so compassionate. You're so loving. You've supported me. I'm so honored to have heard your story today. And for you now to be, you were always a part of the Good Glow community. It's amazing to hear you speak about other guests like Julie and Claire and, you know, share what you've learned. It's so important.
Yeah, it is. And I don't know, maybe that was why I was a little extra nervous coming on. It's because it meant so much to me. And just like I was saying to you on the phone the other day, that like I wished there had been a platform like that for when I was going through my really bad days. You don't know what you're doing for people. It's just incredible. Just to, like, you're giving a voice to people who don't, you know, don't have a voice. You're allowing people to share their stories, and it's so empowering. You know, you're bringing the right people into your life and connecting with energies that just people have experienced maybe what you've, maybe not exactly what you've experienced, but so many people can empathize and relate and to every story that you tell on The Good Glow. It's powerful. Like, it really is.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your story today. And I just know that it's going to help so many people. So thank you so much, Nicola.
Thank you so much, Georgie.
Thank you for listening to the Good Glow podcast with thanks to Vichy. If you enjoyed this episode, please do subscribe to my podcast and leave a review. If you want to learn more about my story, you can follow me on Instagram at georgie.crawford or head over to my website, thegoodglow.ie.